Shrink Wrap Radio number 391, James Hillman's Archetypal Psychology with Jungian analyst Patricia Berry.
Shrink Wrap Radio. All the psychology you need to know and just enough to make it dangerous. It's all in your head. And now here's your host, Dr. Dave.
My guest today is Jungian analyst Patricia Berry, who for 20 years was married to Jungian revolutionary Dr. James Hillman. Now, here's the interview. Dr. Patricia Berry, welcome to Shrink Wrap Radio.
Thank you very much. I'm glad to be here.
Well, I'm really glad to have you on. I've been listening to a series of conversations that you're doing with Robbie Bosnack, another Jungian analyst, and we'll be telling our listeners more about that later in the show and how they can join in and listen as well. That's definitely been of interest to me. And, I should probably mention right at the outset here that James Hillman was not only a teacher of yours, but you were also married to him for 20 years.
Yes.
So I would say you know his thoughts and his approach in some depth.
I do.
Yeah.
Indeed.
Yeah. I want to share a dream with you that I had after I listened to the first conversation that you had with Robbie Bosnack, and it might be get us off to a start to position this.
Oh my goodness!
You probably listened to lots of dreams, right? Yeah. Well, I had this dream in which it was like I was suffering from Alzheimer's or something. I was either some kind of dementia or something, such that my range of comprehension and understanding had shrunk vastly, and a male figure was trying to explain something to me, talking to me much as you would to a child or to a person who's somehow mentally disabled, you know, right? Maybe talking a little louder than necessary and I'm trying to comprehend him and follow. I feel inside, I can feel that I have some loss of comprehension. Almost would be like maybe having been in an accident and somebody saying, "You're in the hospital now. Something happened," you know, that kind of experience. That was the dream. Now, this was after listening to the conversation, the morning after, that evening before, I'd been listening to the conversation between you and Robbie about archetypal psychology. And so, to me, the dream, I can see a number of levels to it, but one that's quite clear to me is my struggle with what you guys were talking about, my struggle to grasp it, and the feeling like, this is tough for me to understand, and like maybe having to be a beginner, like if you're in that accident and you have to learn to walk again, or if you've had that stroke, your brain has to learn again. So that's where I'm coming from in this conversation. I think a lot of my listeners, too, will probably be more or less in the beginner camp, although I've got very sophisticated listeners. As I listened into the series that you two did, you had some very sophisticated people in your audience. It was clear they were already on board the train that you and Robbie were talking about. I thought they were asking very sophisticated questions. So the one of the things that I wrestle with is distinguishing Jungian psychology, traditional Jungian, according to Carl Jung, psychology, and the Hillmanian revolution, if you will. So maybe we could start with your talking about how does archetypal psychology distinguish itself from Jungian psychology?
distinguish is sort of more rational maybe than it is.
Okay.
But it began as a sort of rebellion against Jungian psychology at a time back in Zurich, like 66, 67, 68. A group of us got together once a week with a bottle of wine and mostly listened to Rafael Lopez Pedraza, who was a Cuban, and Jim, and tossed around ideas about polytheism and a lot of, well, Jung really took the hit, you know. It was that one shouldn't think so structurally. One shouldn't think in categories like anima animus or shadow ego self or dynamisms like from ego to self, or one should bracket all that, although we didn't use that word then because we weren't into postmodernism, but not use those kinds of terms, but instead try to approach everything absolutely new and fresh, and particularly, which actually was a, I mean, new and fresh sounds easy, but it was looking at everything only in terms of how it presented itself. We called it sticking to the image, Raphael called it. Jim called it, what was it, honoring the phenomena or something like that.
Okay, now Jim was at that time one of the teachers at the Jung Institute in Zurich, is that right?
He was actually the director of studies.
He was the director. He already had a substantial and longtime career and reputation as a Jungian analyst. Is that right?
Not long time. Okay. I don't think he had graduated that many years before, but he had written several books very quickly. So that put him on the map enough to be disliked by people who were more traditional there.
Right. I remember reading Revisioning Psychology. Was that one of the first books?
No, that was later. That was after the whole thing got worked out as to what archetypal psychology was. Uh-huh. So maybe that's the part that you're looking at.
Okay, it's been a long time since I read it, so I just remember that I read it.
But well, that's the key book for really understanding. Okay. Anyone really wants to study what it came to and sort of what Hillman is about.
I think it would probably be a lot more meaningful to me to read it again because that was now 30 or 40 years ago that I read it, and I think I've learned a lot in between those years.
I tell people to begin with, to get the feeling, begin with Betrayal, which is just a little tiny book about being betrayed, because he does what will be a typical Hillman move, which is look at it's a story about a boy being dropped. His father tells him to jump from the stairs, and the boy finally takes courage and jumps, the father promising he'll catch him. The father steps away and lets him fall. Hillman goes into that, showing why that's a very good thing to have happened.
That reminds me of the story of the scorpion who talks another creature into taking him across the water. I forget what the other creature was. And then the scorpion stings him.
Yes, but that would be to take it, because that was not a good story. I mean, I think what one sort of learned from that fable was you don't be careful of scorpions.
Okay. Yeah.
From Hillman's story, it's when you get betrayed, there's a lot of good stuff that can come from having been.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And that would depend upon what you do with it, right?
Yes, exactly. Exactly. Exactly.
Okay.
What you can make of it, and he lays out a bunch of stuff that helps you.
Okay. So now you still consider yourself a Jungian. You're a Jungian analyst. And yet when I hear you and Robbie talking, sometimes you say, oh, I've been hanging out with the Jungian so much, I've You know, I lost my way. So this is some kind of delicate tightrope that you're walking on that I'm trying to understand more.
Yeah, let me try to be a little bit clear about it. I mean, I'm certainly consider myself a Jungian, and I think Robbie does too. However, we both came out of this archetypal psychology camp, so we are also that. It's not, it doesn't deal with categories, so it doesn't think in terms of categories. It thinks in terms of specific images. That's certainly one part of it.
Okay.
It's based on a sort of multiplicity, multiple viewpoints, or a polytheism rather than a single point of view or a monotheism or a unifying perspective. And that makes a huge difference in a lot of things you do.
Now, I have the impression that metaphorical thinking is a key tool.
Yeah. It's a key tool. It's key also, actually, for Jung. And actually, everything in archetypal psychology was also in Jung. It's just that Hillman made his own selection out of Jung and put it together in his own way.
Yeah.
But Jung says all these things as well.
Yeah, I think of Hillman as the bad boy of Jungian psychology.
That's right. Well, and nowadays, he's one of the bad boys. There's a lot of bad boys. That's it. Good thing about Jungian psychology is it encourages bad boys.
So why did Jungian psychology, why did the world of psychotherapy, indeed, need Hillman? What is it that he's brought to the party that was missing?
Oh, he brings a wonderful, unusual point of view that surprises you every time he says something. Like, we've had 100 years of psychotherapy and the world is getting worse. That's an outrageous statement. And it's something none of us have thought about. I mean, until I heard the title of that book.
Yeah, right.
It's like, what do you mean? Of course psychotherapy has helped the world. Of course it's the most important thing we've had going for the last century. Of course, you say, as a depth psychologist.
Mm-hmm.
Hillman says, the world's just getting worse, even though we've had 100 years of that. So that's just saying things like that blow your mind.
Yeah.
So he's brought that. What he's brought is don't take anything for granted. However you're used to thinking, remember that that's just a way of thinking. It's not reality.
Okay. It's not true. Okay, let's just back up a little bit to the word archetype and archetypal.
Mm-hmm.
This is a big question. What does Jung mean by archetypes and archetypal? And, what does Jim mean by that? What's the difference?
First of all, with Jung, he talks about it in maybe 15 different ways.
Yeah, right. That's what makes it hard.
So that's already very confusing. I mean, Jung was trying to figure out what he meant by it, I think. So different places in his works, he talks about it in a different way. What does Hillman mean by it?
Or what do you mean by it?
I think they both mean the same thing by it. A sort of something that recurs through history, a sort of cultural dominant, a cultural theme that you can probably see in different times in history and perhaps in different cultures.
Okay. Let's talk a little bit about psychotherapy. How do these ideas play out in psychotherapy?
Mm-hmm. With Hillman, and I certainly do therapy in a very archetypal psychology way, nothing is taken for granted. Everything is very specific. If a patient comes in and they talk about their animus, and so I always have to find out, what do you mean? I had a guy just the other day come in talking about his narcissism, and we spent the hour trying to find out what he meant.
Mm-hmm.
For him, this was a self, you know, this didn't need explaining because right. This is a diagnosis and everybody knows what that means. Well, to look at it really carefully, specifically, to see what he means by it, he couldn't even say what he meant by it. That's much more archetypal psychology, looking at specific things in specific contexts and specific moments.
Okay. Although I think many psychotherapists would want to dig down in that way.
Yeah.
Well, say more. Say more about what you do and, you know, what your stance is towards dreams, the unconscious.
It's a lot of stuff.
Yeah, I want to give you a lot of stuff so that you can talk and so that I'm not over-directing here.
We tend to emphasize, as Jung did, but much more frequently than Jung did, the notion that, see, the good thing about Jung is that he did say a lot of different things that are contradictory, and so gives a lot of room for people to do things from it.
Yeah.
The dream means exactly what it says. Jung says that, and archetypal psychology takes that very seriously. So you wouldn't take a dream and put it into a concept, a pre-existing concept. Or you wouldn't take a dream and say, if you're an archetypal psychologist, you wouldn't say this has to do with the anima and animus. You would look particularly at what figure is enacting the role of, let's say, the shadow. What is that figure actually doing? Is that figure shooting a gun at someone? Is that figure pouting in the corner? Is that figure all smiley and friendly and shaking everybody's hand? Is that figure... See, theoretically, everything in the dream other than the dreamer, you know, the dream ego, what the dreamer identifies with, is the shadow or anima or non-animus. So it's other. It's other. And to get what that particular other is in the dream is like working with a fine tool.
Now, yeah. It's interesting that you say that it's other because... Mm-hmm. Wouldn't a lot of people say it's an aspect that it's not other, it's an aspect of the person?
Yeah, that's exactly what they would say. But it's an aspect of the person that they're not identified with in the dream.
Yes.
So that tells you something right there. For some reason, they've identified with themselves in the dream, of course, because that's closest to themselves. That's the ego. And the others are doing other things in the dream. And that creates a tension. Just that there's something other than what one identifies with.
Yeah, yeah. Now, as I listened to what I heard of Hillman, I did hear him. I should let people know you and I had a previous video conversation in which we really bonded and really had a great conversation. Some good sharing. Yeah. And I mentioned that Hillman had come to Sonoma State, and you had come as well, years and years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And at that time, you were talking about polytheism, and he was talking about the gods. Mm-hmm. And so in this dream, in which there are other figures that I don't identify with, I sometimes get the feeling that the Hillmanian point of view is that those are not just projections, but that they have some kind of, I want to say, objective reality. You know, that they are persons on a different plane, perhaps.
He would emphasize that they are very much alive. That they are vibrant and alive, and they should never be reduced to a concept, because that kills them.
Okay.
So they're very, very alive and vital. For him, there's sparks in everything. There's a kind of animal, alive sense in everything. I mean, he's, things are very alive.
Yeah. He's really looking to revitalize psychology, yes, and revitalize the Jungian thought.
Absolutely, yes, and that's was the great benefit of it. It really woke it up in many ways.
Yeah,
or at least for us, it did. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, say more about how you work as a therapist and what you are particularly attuned to.
Well, you mentioned the unconscious a minute ago. Certainly, there's a knot in whatever person comes in with is not really the problem, probably. It's what they think of as the problem, or how they've worked it out in their head and how they're presenting themselves. What you want is what they're not saying.
Yes.
And yet, now you as a therapist would be doing this too.
Sure.
You know, at what they're not saying, what's underneath, what you sense behind what they're saying. So I would say an archetypal approach is, it does that radically, because they're always aware that there are many people in the room, mm-hmm, with the person.
Yeah.
So when a person comes in and says, look, I have this wish, I want to do such and such, well, you don't take it quite as literally as another kind of therapist might. They might take it at the right there at face value. Well, yes, this person would like to go to graduate school. We would immediately wait until we saw that by their behavior, by other things that were going on, it would be immediately not embraced on a counseling level. It's more, you know, I mean, yeah, we wouldn't urge them to. We would watch and see what was really going on.
Just the idea of the term graduate school, again, I'm sort of metaphorically thinking, well, graduate school, that just alone could be very rich, right, in terms of the meanings of graduate school.
Right, right. Right, it could be, or there could be other things going on, like I need to get into a higher level of my own studies, or I need to go to graduate school so I can satisfy my father's demands, or I need to go to graduate school to whatever,
mm-hmm,
so that my father will pay for me for another couple of years.
Yeah. What about some of the classical concepts of resistance, transference,
Resistance, I would say, at least from my archetypal point of view, and all of this is my archetypal point of view. You know, I mean, there's a lot of other people would have different takes on these things. Resistance, I would say, is absolutely given with any phenomena. So any psychological phenomena has resistance within it, and if it doesn't, it should. Because then there's some complexity in it, you know. Then there's it's real. It's interesting. It's it has contrast within itself.
Hmm.
I remember back in the '60s, we used to have people come in who were just, you know,
they were marshmallows. They wouldn't give you much, right?
That's right.
Everything's just cool, man.
Yeah, that's right. Or they're stoned or something. Now that's very hard. You probably remember this too. It's a very hard kind of person to work with.
Yeah.
Because it's so open. There's no tension. There's no resistance. So if something changes, it doesn't really change. The person just floats over there.
I encountered that as a teacher, and as a younger, more radical teacher, I remember one guy in particular who was, you know, into yoga and everything was mellow and fine.
Yeah. Right.
And I ended up wrestling him physically to try to to jolt him out of that.
Physically?
Yeah. We used to do that kind of thing.
That's true. A lot of things in those days.
I wouldn't do that today, I can tell you.
Yeah. So I guess the resistance is to be expected. And the real question is the resistance in the way of the growth?
Or is it part of it?
Or is it part of it? Or is it, yeah, is it the necessary tension so that means when something changes, it will really change? Or is it actually blocking what the person, what would the personality like to do?
Yeah.
You know, in its own unfolding, is it really blocking that kind of unfolding and serving as a way that's just sort of self-satisfied and keeping the personality just exactly the way it was?
So the essence of what you're doing or attempting to do is not to have preconceptions about it,
right,
and to keep exploring it and exploring it so that its particularity, a word you use, can emerge.
Yes, and if there's any preconception, it's probably that the psyche has its own aim. And this is Jung, and even more so Hillman and archetypal psychology. It's Jung talked about it as from a finalistic point of view. You look at where the psyche's trying to go.
Yeah, I love that concept. I've always been very drawn to that concept that, and I don't know if this metaphor comes from Jung or somewhere else, the image of a seed that, you know, it has its destiny in the seed. The seed of a redwood tree might look very much like the seed of several other species, but it has within it a program that,
yeah,
with the right kind of nurturing, will unfold so that it can become fully a tree.
Right, right.
Fully a redwood tree. And
fully a redwood, yeah. That's even Aristotle, by the way. But yes, that's embraced very much by Hillman's book on, what's it called? Is it the Soul's Code? Soul's Code, where he talks about the seed and the, you know, what it grows to, how it's all there in the beginning.
Okay.
But yeah, Jung would say that as well,
and so,
Aristotle would say it.
Yeah, so I guess that, I don't know if that answers the question or not. Which I would ask is, what is it that you're trying to accomplish in therapy? What's the goal of therapy?
We wouldn't even talk about goals much. It's more serving what is there and trying to happen. And like, well, your dream's not a real good example, but with your dream, the dementia, I mean, what did the dream do? It put you into a state to be in.
Yes.
So we could say it's important during this interview that you be like an Alzheimer patient, or you be
right
in your dementia, even though, yeah, there's guy trying to push you,
yeah,
or there's a way, you know, the guy pushing you and the dementia is part of the the tension that's going on.
Yeah,
here.
Yeah.
So it's meaningful. It's meaningful. There's not a not meaningful dream.
Right. Right. I believe that. That's that's something I've taught.
Uh huh. And it's not just trying. The dream is not just trying to show a problem or a diagnosis, but it's also trying to unfold something. That's very archetypal psychology.
Okay. You and Robbie were talking about the diamond, and I don't have enough intellectual background to fully understand everything that's implied by that, the diamond. Maybe you could go into that a bit.
I mean, it's a very old idea. It's certainly a sense of a something between God and human that is quite unique to oneself, in Hillman's terms, and is more than oneself, and that is a terrific dynamis of its own that you have to realize. So it's the way he uses it. It's very particular to one's personality. It's your own daimon is the thing that drives you, and you have to do.
Hmm.
And of course, it gets much more complicated than that, because I think, as I said, maybe in that discussion with Robbie, it's also very dangerous because it's also a demon. I mean, it's more than human, and it doesn't care a lot about the human.
I know that that you're resistant to too much categorization and so on, so I'm sort of reining myself in, you know, from I'm wondering, is this part of the collective unconscious? Does it have some kind of existence outside of ourselves?
I suppose one would say that it's a kind of archetypal idea of some form. I'd say we'd look at it as an archetype because it's been around and is in every culture in some form or another. I mean, the Japanese have the oni. There's various kinds of Ireland is full of leprechauns and sort of half magical creatures.
Yeah.
It's like a magical creature, or it's like a creature that knows, that lives within your personality, that is more than your personality.
Okay.
And there's two sides to it. That's what makes it archetypal. It's both, I said in the course, I think, both demon and daimon. It's yours to struggle with.
Uh-huh. And what about inflation? That's, I think, is a wonderful Jungian concept. Is inflation involved in there? Is that part of the danger?
Yeah. If you identify, let's say, with the daimon side and get full of yourself, you know, I'm meant to be a great artist and this is what I'm giving my life for, and I'm, you know, no relationships, no this, no that, and people better recognize. Okay, that's identifying with that sort of genius force. Kant called it genius force. And forgetting that it also can kill you.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, some people say this about addiction too, that, in fact, Jung did, that in addiction, there's a spirit that wants, the personality wants something and gives up everything for it. So that's an inflation. I mean, because they've narrowed their window to just this thing, and this thing takes hold of them and can take them right over the edge.
Okay. Now, one thing that came up in some of our previous conversation was your sense that there's been some splintering in the archetypal camp, or people who claim to be doing archetypal psychology. Some may be going off the tracks from your point of view. Is that something that maybe I'm not giving it the right characterization, but?
Well, of the people who are really considered archetypal psychologists, you know, from, we all know each other and we've all had to do with each other for years and years. And no, I don't think anybody there is going off the track. They're just doing their own brands of it. And there are lots of different, well, among us, there's as many people, there are that many different brands, because you have to do it your way. What disturbs me is people who pick up the word and they think they're doing Hillman, but they've narrowed it into a tiny little space. I mean, like, political action or things where you name the parts of the personalities as certain types, and that they're taking that as a polytheism. No. Those are too. It's too simple. Hillman was much more complicated than that.
Okay. Are there ways in which your own emphasis as an archetypal psychologist was or is different from Hillman's?
Sure. Yeah. He liked to use sort of straw ideas to bang against, sort of straw men, like in 100 Years of Psychotherapy. Psychotherapy became the straw man, which was not really fair to psychotherapy. It was kind of set up, you know, as the enemy, so it wasn't really accurate. And then, I mean, he does that so that he can show his ideas against it. Contra, it's like a painter with having a background that helps the foreground come forward. Hillman used that kind of exaggeration so that his ideas could come forward. I mean, if you were around right now, I would make a huge case that everything is more complex, that there aren't simple enemies and there aren't simple good things, because he also knows that. But I think for archetypal psychology going forward, it should be much more aware of that instead of stereotyping.
Okay. Now, you and Robbie, in your series, you're talking about alchemy, which is certainly a branch, I guess, of Jungian psychology.
We're talking about Hillman's alchemy, which is not Jung's alchemy.
Yeah. So what's the difference between Hillman's alchemy and Jung's alchemy?
Jung put it together in a sort of conceptual system that moved toward individuation and wholeness. So his whole emphasis was to get things resolved and together. Since Hillman isn't into systems and wholeness at all, It's more just a way of imagining everything as, even if it's not real, as though it were substantial. It's very much Hillman thinking. As though it were substantial, as though it had to do with change that could be imagined as substances.
Okay. So, for example, I'm, having listened to you and Robbie talk, and it put me in mind of one of the pictures from alchemy, and I don't remember the year or which one it is, but there's one that shows a progression of steps. Maybe you know this one, going up towards some pinnacle. The Jungian approach has been organized around that idea of moving through a series of stages, whereas you and Robbie seem to dwell less on progression and more on, I know you talked about cooking a lot, about heat and fire and that transformative process.
Well, that does change things. So it's about change.
Okay.
It's just not as quite as cleanly and clearly. See, there were also many kinds of alchemists. Some that imagined things that way. Some that imagined different goals. You know, some imagined gold. Some imagined a waxy stone. Some imagined many different ways of imagining within alchemy itself. Jung sort of gathered the ones he wanted and made it fit his system, his psychology. Not in a bad way. I mean, he really needed alchemy at the end of his life in order to, so he could feel justified or felt as though he was in a tradition of people who were thinking in a way that he's calling psychological, they were calling alchemical, and that it mattered. It formed something that made sense. Mm-hmm. So that's what Jung was doing with it. It was very important in his thinking. I wouldn't knock it at all.
Yeah.
But it's different from what Hillman is doing.
Okay. Say some more. I'm running out of ammunition here in terms of good questions. So I'm back in the... in my dementia, and I need you to explain it to me.
it's very hard to make this stuff, to talk to the dementia. I wish I'd known you were going to do that, because I would have practiced in my head. I tend to get too abstract myself. You know, I tend to get too complicated. So it's hard.
That's the thing I struggle with. There's the sort of inner critic part of me that says, well, you know, a lot of people would complain about Jung that there's a lot of kind of wordplay and mystification, if you will. Uh-huh. And there's a part of me that has a bit of that take on what we've been talking about, the archetypal psychology. that is kind of fun, and one can become skilled in this form of imaginative wordplay, but does it make a difference? And what is the difference that it makes?
Well, I guess Hillman would say the soul feels seen, feels tended to, feels taken seriously.
I like that.
Good. Oh, good.
I feel that as you say it. I feel that. That feels good.
And
keep on.
Part of what we're doing in therapy by looking at things. Also, it's teaching the person who's in the room, when they hear you working with their dream in a way that takes every little particular thing in the dream seriously, they feel, I felt as a patient, oh my God, really? Am I that rich? Is there something going on in me? It's more than what I'm aware of, and that how did I, as though something in me made up this dream? That's astonishing. So it helped me take myself much more seriously as being more than I thought I was.
Yeah. How old were you then?
23 when I went to Zurich.
Yeah. Wow.
Yeah.
And how does a 23-year-old go to Zurich?
Foolish.
Get interested in Jung and all that. I mean, that's, at that time.
I was in psychology at that point. I had an undergraduate English major, and I started taking a bunch of psychology. I went into therapy, and so I started taking a bunch of psychology courses, as one does, even sitting in on graduate courses.
And this would have been around what year?
From 1961 to, well, let's say, so 1962, 3, 4.
Okay.
There. And I had a very good friend, a guy who, and we were going to go to Zurich together to further our interest in therapy. Actually, Jim and Adolf Bugenbull had come, we were in Columbus, Ohio. They had come to the church where my male friend's mother worked. So they had a tape of both of them speaking. So we listened to that, and that was very exciting. We decided to go to Zurich. That was very exciting. Why, rather than just American psychology?
Had you read any Jung? Did you know anything about Jung at that point?
Yeah.
Okay.
I read a lot of Jung, and that made much more sense. I was sort of existential psychology, humanistic psychology. That's what I was drawn toward.
Mm-hmm, me too.
But at that time, maybe you found a place that taught you that, but for me, it took me to the lab. I mean, it took me into the sciences. And so I wanted somewhere that wasn't about statistics, wasn't in the sciences, but that looked at personality first and foremost and all its workings. And that was depth, just the word depth. I thought, I'm so screwed up that it better be something deep in order to turn me into, you know, any sort of worthwhile person.
Yeah, well, you and I are of the same age, roughly. And so psychology at that time was really being taken over pretty much by behaviorism. And by sort of a radical objectivist, logical positivist kind of perspective. So you as did I, had a hunger for something that was much more personal.
Yeah, human. I was interested in human and emotion and, you know, all that. Well, existential psychology was what I was excited about. Humanistic psychology.
Yeah. Okay, so you go to, and it's interesting, you and Robbie, I guess, are also kind of an age, and you were both there at around 23 years of age when you got to know each other?
Yeah, I'm about, 4 years older than Robbie, and so he came 4 years later.
And so now here you guys are elder statesmen of Jungian psychology, I'm really interested in these early beginnings, though. So tell us more about this path of discovery that you went on.
Well, for me, once I got to Zurich, I had no money, of course, because I didn't think about that. So I worked as an au pair, and that gave me time to go to classes. I went to these classes, which was all old ladies, sort of religious, you know, the self and the this and the that and all this kind of stuff that turns you off about Jungian psychology turned me off.
Yeah, there is a kind of sometimes almost churchy feel to it.
Yeah, it's a kind of religious. Well, part of Jung's concern was meaning, you know, and to rescue modern man from meaninglessness and lack of religiousness. So that was part of his aim, really. Yeah. You know. So there it is. I got immediately terribly depressed because it wasn't all that it had said it would be. You know, it wasn't as humanistic as my American mind thought of humanistic. I worked with Binswanger's daughter. What's her name?
That's okay. I have no idea.
Anyway, I worked with his daughter because he was the founder of existential psychology. And even that, she was too quiet and too, you know, nice, and it didn't work. So I would sleep and just got depressed. It was awful until I heard a course by Hillman, and that woke me up. You know, I mean, I thought,
what in particular was it that woke you up? What did he say that really connected for you?
Well, first of all, it was his style. He was academic and intellectual, so that woke me up because that's what I was used to. This was an intelligent man, and that made a big difference. Then, because at that time, see, Jung had just died 5 years earlier. So a lot of people, these are all people who worked with Jung, and, you know, he was a kind of saint. So to hear somebody that wasn't speaking of him as a saint, but in, more rational terms, was great. I heard him talk on animals. I heard him talk on alchemy, and that was very exciting to me. I could feel the alchemy. I could feel the substances, and if change was about cooking, get it? I could get it, you know, or transforming, you know, milk and cream to cheese. I mean, that I could get. Is that what's happening in me? I'm getting, you know, is that what culture is? Seems to me it is. It's making cheese out of milk. You know, it's making leather out of raw skin. It's making, you know, I mean, those are sort of upgrading of natural products.
Yeah.
That change, that was interesting to me. Because I could feel that as something that was psychological. That's how I matured. That's how I got better at something. So that all matched up for me.
Yeah. Getting better at something. Say a little bit more about that.
Getting better in a qualitative sense. I mean, again, just this idea of from skin to leather, culture. From the law to the cultural.
Yeah, you and Robbie actually were talking about this in terms of the fire, the energy, the cooking, and the need to contain and temper it at the same time so that it's sustained over time, discipline.
Exactly. Yeah, yeah. See, that's all a way of imagining how to handle oneself, one's own energies, one's own processes, one's life. You can see that in a lot of different places. If you imagine it in those metaphors, it just becomes richer.
Yes.
And more distinct. I mean, you know. Depression, there are many kinds of depression. and just to get exact descriptions of the different kinds or exact images. An angry black dog depression. Or, you know, some smelly something or other depression. These are very different states.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So to be able to feel that variety is, I mean, that's helpful in itself.
Yeah. So maybe this is a good time to talk a bit about the course that you and Robbie are doing together by way of tantalizing our listeners who might want to drop in on it.
Yes. You can still get in, and we've had 3 meetings so far, but there are tapes, sound tapes,
audio tapes, recordings, audio recordings,
yeah,
MP3 files.
That's right. you can get after the actual meeting if you can't make the actual meeting, depending on where you live in the world. Sometimes the time is wrong. Or sometimes you miss one. So getting the recordings allows you not to miss anything.
Yes.
So
and there's collateral reading. Is that right? Because you guys are working your way through a book, but I never heard what the title of the book was.
It's Hillman, and it's Alchemy. Hillman's Alchemy.
That's the title of the book?
Yeah.
Okay.
I just looked for the book, and I don't have it right here, but Alchemy is in the title. Yeah, it's one of his collected works. Right now, that is out of print, so what you can get is a download, a Kindle,
mm-hmm.
or some sort of download like that, so it's easy to get that. And also, we pass out before each class just sheets of paper that from the book that you can print out, and we have those marked, the sentences that we're going to be working on.
Uh-huh.
So it's easy for someone to follow. They can just look at that as we go along.
Yeah, so there are more than 18 countries, people involved, about 100 people attending each session virtually.
Right. There were about 150 or so signed up, over 150.
Yeah, great. So I'll promote this a little bit more in the words that I that I utter after this interview.
Okay. We would appreciate that.
Yeah, yeah.
Very fun, and it's very fun for Robbie and me to be working together because we haven't, as mature people, we haven't been able to come together and see where we come from now.
Yeah, that really comes through, and it's fun to hear that aspect of it, of two friends coming together and kind of the intellectual play back and forth.
Yeah, we enjoy it. We're enjoying it a lot.
Yeah. Well, is there anything else that you would like to add or to say, something that you were planning to say, hoping to say, thought you'd say that you didn't get a chance to?
Not that comes right to mind.
Okay.
So, thank you very much.
Well, thank you, Patricia Berry. I really want to thank you for being on Shrink Wrap Radio today.
Okay, thank you.
As you may already know, I typically conduct these interviews at a distance using Skype. In this case, Pat was in Maine, and I, of course, am in California. One thing, however, that was unusual about today's interview is that we were both on camera. I usually keep my camera off and suggest that the guests do the same, my thinking being that we will use less bandwidth and therefore have a better audio signal. The downside of that approach, of course, is that we can't see one another, and consequently there is often a certain amount of over-talking, that is, the guest and I talking at the same time, especially as I'm trying to cut in and get a word in edgewise. Now, often I edit a certain amount of that out later. A few days ago, Pat and I felt that we should connect to speak a little bit about how we wanted to structure the interview, and she had a new video camera that she was wanting to try out. So we ended up having a video chat in which we discovered not only that her camera works quite well, but also that we have quite a bit in common. In fact, we got on quite famously, and within 20 minutes or so felt like old friends. For one thing, she asked me how I got into podcasting, and I'm afraid I went into a fairly long answer, probably giving too much of my personal history. But she's a great listener, and I had the experience of really being seen and appreciated, which, as it turns out, and you heard in our discussion, is a key feature of successful therapy in her view and mine as well. Also, because of the lovely bond that we were able to create in such a short time, I felt free to start our interview off with the dream that you heard me share. Even as I struggle somewhat with the nuances of archetypal psychology according to Hillman, Berry, and Bosnack, I think I'm doing somewhat better than the demented self of my dream. By the way, if you haven't heard it or haven't heard it recently, you might enjoy listening to my interview with Jungian analyst Robert Bosnack on Shrink Wrap Radio episode number 328, in which we discussed the Red Book and cycles of change. As you heard us mention, Pat Berry and Robbie Bosnack are conducting an ongoing webinar on James Hillman's Alchemy. The sessions can be listened to and participated in live or not. If you're able to be there online when they're happening, that's what we mean by live. And if you can't be there, that's okay, because either way, you'll have access to the audio recordings. As you heard, I've listened to two of their sessions and found them very thought-provoking. They are pitched at a pretty high level, and so I should think it would be particularly appealing to those of you who are already therapists or who are planning to be therapists. In addition, there are CE units available for this experience as well. By the time you hear this, you will probably have missed three of the live sessions, but there are more to come. I believe the dates are as follows: January 9 and 23, February 13 and 27, March 20, April 3 and 17, and May 1, May 8, and May 29. The series is brought to you by my strategic partners, the Jung Platform and the Depth Psychology Alliance. You can purchase individual sessions for $15 or get the whole series of 10 sessions for $139. Be sure to take advantage of my discount code to save 15%. That code is Dr. Dave, which has to be spelled D-R-D-A-V-E, no punctuation. I think it's an excellent value and encourage you to take advantage of this opportunity. Now, if you decide to do so, just go to shrinkwrapradio.com, look in the left-hand sidebar for the banner ad for the Jung platform, click on that. That'll take you to a place on my site where I describe the seminar in a bit of detail, and then you'll see a link to the sign-up area on the Jung platform.
Thomas here, from upstate New York. I just want to say that I listened to my first podcast, number 354, What Aging Men Want, and I was prompted immediately to make a modest donation of $20. First, because I received the most prompt and personal customer service I have ever gotten when I called in a question to Dr. Dave about Shrink Wrap Radio. But much more significantly, after listening to just one program, I was inspired to get off the dime I had been sitting on procrastinating for weeks about contacting a shrink. And to boot, as a result of Dr. Robinson's interview, I have picked up a copy of The Odyssey to reread after 50 years since reading it the first time in high school. If you are into value, think about what you get. In today's economy, where a $20 bill doesn't buy you what a $10 bill bought in a grocery store just a year ago, you get, with Shrink Wrap Radio, hundreds of entertaining, insightful, and helpful discussions. They are free. Yes, indeed, and that is real value. But still, to help out with a few bucks, it is still real value when you think of this vast resource just waiting for you to discover new areas of enlightenment. Myself, I hate exercising, but I love listening. And now I'm walking more and longer, because I am now listening to Shrink Wrap Radio on my MP3 player. chip in and you will get a lot of value for your contribution. And you will feel good about doing so, just as I did. Thanks.
Thank you, Tom in New York. I hope you're still out there and still a satisfied listener. Thanks to all of you who voted on our recent poll as to whether I should stick to the high-energy, up-tempo, transitional music I've been using of late, or return to the near-horn music or the piano music of some of my older shows. Well, the results are in, and the up-tempo music wins. Yay! The poll is now closed. I'm afraid I don't have much in the way of announcements today, other than to say we have no new transcripts on the site. If you'd like to volunteer to transcribe one of your favorite episodes, please drop me an email letting me know. If you go to the Transcripts tab on our site, you can see which shows have been transcribed already and which are missing. You'll see that many of our interviews have been transcribed, and that's all been the result of volunteers such as yourself. By the way, you only transcribe the interview itself, not my commentary or the announcements or the listener emails. So please do consider stepping forward.
Hi, this is Fernando Blanco from Mexico City. You're on the couch, on a rock, on a boat, on a plane, with Dr. Dave.
Thank you, Fernando Blanco. I hope you're still listening down there in Mexico. Now let's go to a recent communication from our listener community, and it's from Sarah Hannah Radcliffe, Canadian therapist, author, frequent guest, and supporter of Shrink Wrap Radio. And Sarah Hannah writes, "Hi, Dr. Dave. I just finished listening to your interview with Dr. Pieter Rosau, and I just had to tell you how much I enjoyed it. Dr. Rosau's wonderful Australian accent and soothing style of speech were so pleasant to listen to that it might not even have mattered what he said, but in fact what he said was absolutely brilliant. His theories make so much more sense than most of what I've come across in the thinking on the subject of emotional distress, depression, and anxiety. In fact, I have to confess that I came to very similar conclusions a long time ago, without the grounding of the fine brain research that Dr. Rosau has produced. It's so reassuring to know that there is real science to back up the thinking that the solutions to our problems are not to be found in a shock to the brain or a pill in a bottle. I also like Dr. Rosau's assertion that learning is so much easier in the absence of stress and pressure, and thought to myself that this is exactly what makes your podcast so special. I listen to so many professional podcast training sessions in psychology, but none has the lighthearted, fun feel that yours has. Your guest always presents valuable information, but the musical interludes, love the Western-style music you've had of late, the listener emails, the polls, and the plugs for donations, it all makes for an absolutely wonderful learning experience. If he put your listeners through the brain scan machine, I'm sure Dr. Rosau would find that we all form millions of new neurons for every hour we spend on Shrink Wrap Radio. Thank you so much, Dr. Dave." Well, thank you so much, Sarah Hannah Radcliffe. I love your image of all the millions of neurons that are being created by these podcast interviews. And I'm glad that you like the light feel of the show, because sometimes the topics we discuss are in fact painful and maybe pick at some of the scabs in people's psyches in the course of their lives. But at the same time, we try to keep a bit of perspective, keep everything in perspective, and approach life with joy and gratitude. So thanks a lot. And with that, I think we'll wrap it up for today. As always, you can send email to shrink@shrinkwrapradio.com. You can also leave comments about individual shows in the comments area on the site. And you can leave voicemail on our phone at 206-309-4707. You can also leave voicemails using our iPhone Android app, which I haven't mentioned in a while, and you can find full details about those apps on the Apps tab at shrinkwrapradio.com. Thanks to today's guest, Jungian analyst Dr. Patricia Berry, for helping us to understand the archetypal psychology of James Hillman. With any luck, my next guest will be world-class Stanford psychologist Dr. Philip Zimbardo, speaking about his new book on PTSD. So until then, this is Dr. Dave saying, it's all in your mind.
You've been shrink-wrapped by Dr. Dave. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make you dangerous.